Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, why is the DWB still messing up their state pension sums when it comes to women? Also, more warnings about not saving enough for our future. This time it's aimed at workers in their 40s and comes from This Is Money's pensions agony uncle, Steve Webb. So how much do you need to save for your retirement? And what's the best way to max out your pension contributions while on maternity leave? Also, today is now the time to pounce on Big B Scottish Mortgage and Fundsmith after their savaging on the stock market. Tanya looks at big picture trends that could make you a fortune over the next couple of decades. And Simon asks, as petrol prices jump again, is it time for a VAT cut to help motorists? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, a retired pub worker wrongly refused a state pension when she turned 66 in April is urging other women to challenge similar government mess-ups. Estelle Henley, enlisting the support from former pensions minister and This Is Money pensions agony uncle, Steve Webb, found out she was actually entitled to around £4,400 a year, quite substantially more than nothing. But other women who have reached state pension age since 2016 and are divorced or widowed could have lost out on far bigger sums. Now, this new era is different to the previous scandal discovered by Sir Steve Webb and This Is Money, that tens of thousands of elderly women were underpaid £1 billion in a scandal affecting those who reached state pension age before 2016. Tanya, unravel this all for us. What is this new era? Tell us about Estelle Henley et al.
Well, it's worrying that the DWP seems to be getting some of its sums wrong for a different group of women, a younger generation of women who are turning 66 since 2016. And I should emphasise that we know of four cases for definite so far, and it was an error that the DWP itself apparently discovered that they alerted Steve to in a Freedom of Information request back in 2019. The crux of it is the system was changed in 2016 so that women could stand on their own state pension record. They weren't going to have to depend on their husband's record to decide what they were going to get. But there were certain concessions to do with this because they had paid in various ways. So to iron out various unfair things that might have been left in there, they were, for instance, if they'd ever paid the married women's stamp, allowed potentially to get some state pension even if they didn't qualify for it on their own. This is where Estelle Henley comes back in, because she didn't have a strong enough record to stand on her own, but she was aware of this concession for having paid the married women's stamp in the past. This was actually started being phased out back in the 70s, and it all was about this rather, you know, insulting view that women who were married were just going to be completely dependent on their husband in retirement. So as you can understand, it started being phased out, and it was a lower rate that women paid, but some were allowed to carry on paying it. And that is where this concession comes in, and where the DWP appears anyway not to have applied it as they should in cases where women have been, you know, retiring more recently. Estelle obviously was aware of the concession. She enlisted Steve and fought it and won. And as you said, 4,400 is a lot more than zero. If she was divorced or widowed, she would get a higher sum. We're looking at more like 7,400 a year. Now, I mean, that is not enough really to live on in retirement, but it is still a sizable sum for somebody who hasn't maybe got many, many savings, other assets or backup. Steve has made the point that there might be quite a small number of women affected by this, but it's life-changing for the four cases he's discovered so far. And therefore, he's called on the DWP to take a much closer look at this. As I said in the beginning, the DWP has been aware of this since at least 2019, because they admitted that there had been errors in this FOI request. And he can't understand why they haven't eradicated this. They did say that they were going to put in more quality controls, and do extra training after the previous state pension scandal, which we've talked about a lot. And he really wants them to go back and look at all low awards or zero awards, because this is the kind of situation where a woman will apply for her state pension and be told she's going to get nothing. And they might, she might be unaware of this concession and never know. That's the crux of it. So we're going to continue investigating it. It's quite a tricky one, because a lot of women don't know about the married women's stamp, or if they ever paid it, or when they paid it. And there's various rules attached to it. And I can't say much more about investigations at the moment, because we don't know if any of the women we've been speaking to, whether there was any error involved in their case or not. But it's definitely one that we're going to continue looking into.
So what should you do then if you think you have been affected by this?
Well, you can, of course, contact the DWP and ask, but you can also contact us and we will try to help. Steve Webb and I will try to help. We'll look at each case that comes in. If we think there's a possibility, then we will try and help, potentially by taking it to the DWP press office for you.
I know you said only a few. Steve thinks not as many, perhaps, as the previous blunder, which is, you know, looking at £1 billion kind of scandal. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking this could be? How wide could this go?
It's really difficult to put an actual number on it. Some years ago, there was an estimate that 10,000 women might be, in this group that are eligible, in that they're retiring, paid the married women's stamp for at least a year within the 35 years running up to their state pension age, which is currently 66. So that's the criteria. So out of those 10,000, obviously there will be lots that haven't had any error in them, but the crucial bit is working out how many have had errors. Four women have obviously come forward, and Steve has dealt with their cases. We'll have to see how many more we get and what ends up transpiring on that front.
Is it a case, though, Tanya, that for this blunder, for the previous one, for everyone, that you have to make the claim? Or have DWP said, there clearly is something up here, I think we should do something about this and proactively contact people that may... Is that going to happen?
Well, with the previous scandal, in the end, launched a great big correction exercise, a vast correction exercise involving hundreds of staff. And they are systematically going through older women's cases, and they're prioritising the most elderly and widows from what they've said. In this particular case, Steve has obviously asked them to do a review, but it's unclear at this stage whether they're going to. Their statement to us was really that they do everything possible to identify and put right errors. That's the gist of it. And they'll look closely at any cases. It is worrying, though, that after the previous scandal, that there are still recent errors. Estelle Henley reached state pension age in April. So
it's pretty fresh, isn't it, this?
Yeah, it is.
Simon, I've just gone onto the DWP website. Department for Work and Pensions is responsible for welfare, pensions and child maintenance policy. As the UK's biggest public service department, it administers the state pension and a range of working age, disability and ill health benefits to around 20 million claimants and customers. It's a lot of people. And that's a lot of things that they do. And we've spoken about two pretty big blunders. Could there be potentially more in other areas? You'd imagine so.
Well, I mean, the signs would indicate that that is the possibility, wouldn't they? If you contact the DWP and ask them something, be it about your pension or other benefits, things like that, you would like to think that you could work on the basis that the information they gave you was correct. I certainly would. I must admit, it is generally what you do when you call up an organisation or a company, is you work on the basis that what they're telling you is actually correct. And we do tend to find that that's not always the case. We talked last week about energy bills, didn't we? About someone who managed to get £2,000 back from their energy supplier, and then the energy supplier turned around and said, oh, actually, you owe us £2,000. And it's like, well, how can that be correct? And it turned out that it wasn't correct. They couldn't explain it. And it's a similar thing. But you would like to think that the government departments, particularly the DWP, operate to a higher standard than failed energy supplier bulb. The evidence of the past, certainly with these cases of women in their state pension that Tanya and Steve have uncovered, is that that's not necessarily always the case. So I would definitely urge anyone who is told anything that they just think doesn't sound right to check up on it and keep chasing. The problem is that you can keep chasing and you can hit a brick wall. But that's why we're lucky that we've got people like Tanya and Steve helping read us out.
Indeed. We'll stick with pensions. But Simon, I'm dying to ask you. It's been not a great week for Britain, you know, economically, politically. Talking about things like DWP mess ups and all that sort of thing. Obviously, that's been going on for some time. But are we in a big old mess, Simon? Is Britain doomed?
What are you talking about? We're going to bring back Right to Buy, and we've cooked up a scheme to give people mortgages if they've got universal credits. No, it's totally fine. We've got great ideas coming out of our ears in this country.
Careful.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I mean, it's all relative, isn't it? What can I say? You know, if you look around the world at other countries, and they're not doing a bang up job either, are they? So we're in a difficult position at the moment.
Are you optimistic, Simon?
Economically speaking, and perhaps politically speaking, but I'd like to, you know, go with the Yaz theory. The only way is up.
Or you could go with what my dad says, there is no situation so bad that it can't get worse. Anyway, talking of Steve Webb, nothing to do with getting worse. Steve Webb is an absolute hero for This Is Money and pensioners. But anyway, talking of Steve Webb, as we were earlier, he says the UK pension system, God, the misery carries on, doesn't it? It's a slow motion car crash, Tanya. And he's concerned about workers, particularly in their 40s, rather depressing for this podcast, not saving enough for retirement. So older generations, of course, benefited from that golden era of pension benefits, while those in their 20s have, you know, mathematically a long time to save. So it's us middle agers then that are again being told that, like Britain, we're slightly screwed. Tanya, is that right?
But some people are going to struggle, that's for certain. Steve also refers rather colourfully to a ski slope of doom when it comes to pensions. Talking about here is people who are aged in their 40s are in a particularly difficult situation when it comes to their pensions. And this is very well known in the pensions industry, and Steve is putting voice to it in the Work and Pensions Committee hearing this week, which is why it's been brought to wider attention. But the issue for people in their 40s is they've missed out on the glory days of final salary pensions, which were really generous. And people who are retired on them now are fairly well set up. They've got a guaranteed income until they die. And it's usually quite generous if they had a decent job. What they've also done is they've missed out for many years on auto-enrolment. In some cases, they wouldn't even have been in a pension scheme. Whereas with auto-enrolment, the younger generations, people who are in their 20s, shall we say now, from their late 20s, maybe 30, early 30s onwards, will reap the full benefit of auto-enrolment. They will be in a pension for their entire working career. And so although they certainly won't be in as good a position as people on final salary pensions, they will still be in a better position. There's all sorts of other issues with people who are aged in their 40s as well. Some unfortunate people might have lost their job in a financial crash and lost their job again in the pandemic. And these are all risky points because you might stop paying your pension and then not start again. And that is potentially in your highest earning years, maybe in your 40s and 50s. So Steve, he's definitely identifying a real problem. And also you have to take into account that these people often have at the maximum point in terms of the calls on them, elderly relatives, children entering teenage years, going off to university, costing them an awful lot of money. We've obviously got the cost of living crisis as well. So that is the problem that he is talking about here.
I think we all accept what Sir Steve is saying. What was the audience, and therefore what was he hoping to achieve? What outcome does he want?
Well, I think firstly, one of the points he's making is that we need to get employers paying more into pensions. So at the moment, under auto-enrolment, 8% goes in and the employer only has to pay in 3%. And he says 8% is not enough. that we need to get more going into our pensions and that employers need to pick up a bit more of the tab. Because actually, if you look at auto-enrollment versus the old system of defined benefit pensions, employers get a pretty easy ride on this one compared to what they used to get on final salary pensions and stuff like that. Secondly, we need to get more self-employed people saving into pensions. There's a big gap there. Unless they have someone nudging them along the way and saying, you need to open a pension and start paying some money into it. And it sounds like a lot of money, but you need to be paying this amount into it based on what you're earning, then self-employed people have a real tendency not to open pensions. And he's also making the point that we need to engage a bit better with our pensions, which actually, to be fair, people have engaged a lot more with. And there's a lot more information out there around the whole, like, here's what you need. Are you going to have enough? This is what you need to do. But there is this concern that there are people falling through the gaps there.
Mm. So the timing, Tanya, for people who are not saving into their pension at the moment must just feel there's a cost of living crisis. I'm struggling to pay the bills at the moment. And literally every month I'm hearing I'm not saving enough into my pension. You know, like you said, the kids, the parents, the elderly parents, all the things that you've coming at you. It must just be so upsetting, I think, to keep hearing this.
Yes, it must be. It must be really worrying. I think the best thing to do is take a really straightforward look at your finances. The priorities are going to be food and shelter for people really on the bottom rungs, you know, in terms of earnings or even not earning in this current crisis. Now, in that scenario, you're obviously not going to be thinking about a pension. I think, though, that if you are earning, if you have got an income of any kind and you are looking at what to cut back on, try not to cut back on the pension. Lots of other things are going to be Justin, for your attention in terms of bill paying, but try and preserve your pension payments if possible. I would also say that for people who are married or in a couple, we'll get onto this when we talk about maternity pay and pensions later, but I think it's really worth making a joint project of your pensions as well as other things like joint household bills. It's often the case that one partner is earning more than the other. And you can subsidise each other in terms of your pension payments. For example, a lot of employers will put more into your pension if you put more in. Now, you might not be able to afford that, but if your partner can afford to subsidise you doing that, then you're both going to be better off in the long run by maxing out both of your pension contributions. It's things like that, I suppose, that might make the difference. People are going to have to think a lot harder about their finances in the current crisis. And I would just put pensions really high up on the list, not obviously as high as food and shelter, but keep it near the top of the list.
Simon, do you think it's likely that the auto enrollment amounts are going to change? I mean, we're talking about pressures on people, us consumers, but also huge pressures going on at the moment on business. That would just add to it, surely.
Yes, there are. And businesses are wondering how they're going to give the staff the pay rises that staff are asking for. Although most of them aren't in the position where their staff are going to walk out, like all the train drivers are. But the issue is really, we're kind of, it's in businesses' best interests for people to have a decent retirement and spend some money in retirement. And I think that maybe it would be fair enough if we bumped that up. If we could get it to, you put in, the auto-enrollment was 5% each, that would be a really good place to get to, but you still need to get a bit more in. Broadly speaking, there's a couple of rules of thumb and various things about how much you should be paying into your pension. Broadly speaking, pension experts say people should be putting away at least 12% of their earnings into defined contribution pensions. There was a report that actually said we should set a national target for every worker saving 15% of their salary. Now, the good news is that's talking about including employer contributions and tax relief, right? So pension tax relief is a real nice booster. So for basic rate taxpayer, it gives you a 25% uplift and on the money you pay in. And that's to make up for the basic rate tax you pay at 20%. So you take tax off at 20%, you have to go up by 25% to get back to the point where you started. For higher earners, it's more. Some consider that unfair, but it's also because they paid more tax in the first place. And the idea is you get back to the point before you pay tax. Or if you're lucky and your employer has a salary sacrifice scheme, it all comes out before you get paid. And you not only get the tax relief, you also get the benefit of the national insurance there as well. Now, if someone's got a generous employer who will match their contributions up to a decent level, then they would only need to pay in just under 6.7% of their salary, because their employer could potentially pay the same, and basic rate tax relief would add a further 1.675%, and that gets you to just over 15%. But to put some numbers on it, if you've got someone on the median salary is about £30,000 in this country. So if they were paying in 5% every month of their salary, they'd be paying in £125. But they're getting £75 going in from their employer, and they're getting £31.25 in pension tax relief. So for £125 that you pay into your pension, you're actually seeing £231.25 going in there. And if someone said to you, if you give me 125 quid, I'll turn it into 231 quid, you'd say, that sounds like a good deal. Here's 125 quid. That's what happens when you pay the money into your pension. And that's why people should pay the money into their pension. The risk is if we keep upping contributions from employees, then there's a concern we hit that tipping point where the nudge effect of auto-enrollment stops working and people start noticing it and start opting out. But I think we could probably nudge in a little bit more, to be perfectly honest. But the thing is, the earlier you start, the better, the compounding effect that rolls around. Sometime in the future, you will look back and you will go, I am glad that I saved that money into my pension, that it was invested into the stock market, and now I've got a lot more money and the prospect of a much better retirement than if I hadn't have done it. And that goes for people who are employees and self-employed. And I cannot get this message through enough to anybody who is listening mm-hmm. to this podcast who is self-employed, okay? Get yourself set up. Make sure you're paying some money into a pension. It's dead easy. What you want to do is open a self-invested personal pension. Okay, you can open them at any number of investing platforms, the big ones, AJ Bell, Hargreaves Lansdown, Interactive Investor, and so on, Vanguard. And you can either choose one where you choose the investments yourself, or you can choose one where they help you out and choose the investments for you. And so all you got to do is set it up, pay the money in. These are very successful companies, many of these investment companies, so they make it really, really easy for you to do. So just go and do it and pay some money in. Mm. And, you know, it's hard work when you go, oh, no, but hang on a minute. That means I'm going to have to be putting 250 quid a month into this pension. And I'm not doing that now. And I don't have 250 quid. But just get started, even if it's a lower level, and try to build up to it after this cost of living crisis has passed, because you really need to start saving that money.
Also, as part of the self-employed crew here that I am, I'd imagine we're quite good at that, because we have to sort of set aside mentally things like tax. So, you know, factor it into your pay, and then maybe you need to ask for a pay rise. But Tanya?
One other point on self-employed people. Many have been employed in the past and had a pension scheme. Some will allow you to carry on paying in, and rather than going and setting up a SIP, you can just carry on paying into your old work pension. And it is definitely worth finding out if you have got one and you're now self-employed, whether you can still do that, because it will take a lot of the hassle out of it.
Great advice from you both. And we're going to stick with pensions. Tanya, you tease us up. We're going to talk about maternity and pensions, because you have a reader question relating to this subject. Your reader, due to have a baby in a few months, is keen to maintain pension contributions while on leave. Tanya, take up the story.
Well, this is a really important issue, actually. This reader is really going to try and do the right thing in terms of making sure her pension contributions do not go down just because she's taking a career break to have a baby. It can't really be emphasised enough that this is a really key tipping point for women. Lower pay than men is obviously an issue as well in terms of the gender pensions gap. But the real crucial turning point for many women is when they start doing unpaid caring work, which is what looking after a child is. And it happens at this point when they go on maternity leave, and they immediately start falling behind in their contributions. It may be the biggest turning point of all when it comes to women's pensions. So we got an expert from AJ Bell to explain the process and what you need to do. It does get a bit complicated because there are various phases of maternity pay. The first 20 weeks, you're on full pay. Then you're on statutory maternity pay. That's another 39 weeks, which is split into two. And then you go on to unpaid maternity leave. And the thing that you need to do is work out how many contributions you're going to be down for, you know, not in the first phase, you're going to be fine in the first phase, but in those second two phases, if you take them, then how much you're going to be down and what is the best way to make them up. In most cases, it sounds like the best way to do it is to either increase your contributions before you go on maternity leave or after, or do a combination. There is also the possibility of putting in a lump sum to make up whatever you've calculated the loss would be. But you need to be a little bit careful with that. If you aren't, for instance, maxing out your employer contributions, then it might be better to do it in terms of increased contributions, because then you get more on that front as well. And if you're doing salary sacrifice, it's a bit of a similar scenario. It is better to up your monthly contributions, then put a lump sum in. So it's a really important question and answer. And I'll go back to what I was saying before about making a joint project. I mean, a baby is a joint project with a partner. And in this particular scenario, especially if your partner is still earning, paying into their pension, share the load. If you subsidise your partner's contributions through this period, you'll both end up with maxed out pensions. You'll have a much better retirement together. And I'll just say for the cynics out there that if you do most unfortunately break up with your partner at a later stage, it takes an awful lot of the hostility and hassle out of the process of splitting pensions, even if they're not going to be the same amount. But if you both put a lot into maxing them out up to that point, it's a much easier process to divide them up if that is unfortunately becomes necessary.
Well, you've got to think of these things, Tanya. You've got to think of these things.
Yes, absolutely. You should take that into account as well. Unfortunately, that is also one of the reasons to max it out. You might end up being depending only on your own pension with the best of intentions, but you might end up, and as we've discussed, your state pension, you stand alone on your own record if you're a woman or a man. And so the work pension is just another side of that. So I would definitely urge women, I know they've got an awful lot on at the stage when they're about to take maternity leave, but it is really worth, this is the point where you could fall behind forever because of the compound growth that Simon was talking about. If you're not putting those contributions in at that point, then the gap starts opening and will never, never, never close.
Right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, how's it been this week?
Hi, Simon. Well, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday were actually pretty mundane markets. We're meandering along, which was to be expected. The two main events of the week were US inflation, which was today, Friday, and European Central Bank meeting on Thursday. Firstly, the ECB met largely in line with what's expected. And then from the next month, we're expecting them to raise interest rates and to continue that through their next meetings. However, as we finished Thursday, the S&P 500 had its 10th 2% down day of the year. And unfortunately, it looks like it's going to be 11 today. We saw inflation coming in at a new multi-year high, 40-year high, 8.6%, and markets have tumbled. So as things stand, markets will most likely struggle to find any support in the short term.
And what do investors have to look forward to next week?
It's a busy one, which on the face of it is probably not great news for markets. But here we go. From the UK, we had the latest GDP reading, some jobs data. And then on Thursday, we had the Bank of England, which is meeting. All of those things are important in their own right, including a policy announcement from the Bank of Japan. But the number one event, that's going to be on Wednesday as the Federal Reserve meet. And rates are expected to rise, but it will be their comments, probably on this recent inflation number, which will have most of the market's focus.
Okay, Sam, well, thank you very much for updating us.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Some of the country's biggest and most popular investment funds have seen sharp price falls this year. So what should investors do? Sell up and move on? Or is actually now a good time to buy these long-established funds on the cheap? Simon, what's been going on?
What's been going on is that there's been a bit of a shake-up on the stock markets in recent times. There has been a shift whereby some of the most highly rated growth company shares have taken a real pasting as interest rates have started to rise much faster than people thought due to the fact that inflation turned out to be not quite as transitory as all the central banks assured us that it was going to be. And we've seen inflation hit 9% in this country. Inflation is raging away in the US. We've been raising interest rates since December time. Four rises in an incredibly short period of time that would have shocked anyone who was used to the Bank of England's slumbering ways since the financial crisis. The Fed's on the case as well in the US, and that's the more important factor here, because the Federal Reserve is, you know, the US economy is the largest. The US stock market dominates. The Federal Reserve runs the show over there. Now, what that has meant is that some of these very highly rated disruptive growth companies where people think they're going to make lots and lots of profits in the future, so I'm willing to pay a very high multiple of earnings for the share prices, or perhaps even they don't even have any profits at the moment, but they're going to make them in the future, have become much less attractive to people because they prefer the certainty of profits today rather than the promise of jam tomorrow. And that's seen a shift into some of the less fashionable stocks on the market and a downgrading of people's appetite for risk. So the one stock market that's actually done quite well this year, astonishingly, is the FTSE 100. But because it's the FTSE 100, it's managed to outperform in a way that's just not being as bad as the other ones. So it's not really doing that great. It's just not doing as badly as the S&P 500, etc. But it means that there are investment trusts such as Scottish Mortgage, which has been the poster child for growth investing over recent years, that have taken an absolute hammering. Stocks down, the share price is down almost 40% from its peak. But then there's also been some other very popular funds, such as Fundsmith, which is Terry Smith's fund, that doesn't invest in the same kind of more speculative growth stock portfolio that Scottish Mortgage does. It tends to be more established businesses, but that's down 15%. We've got some others, Baillie Gifford American, that's again a very popular sort of disruptive growth company fund, that's down 45%. So basically, these are the kind of numbers that normally attract people on the basis that what's gone down by a lot will probably go up again in the future. But that's not the only way to invest and not really the cornerstone of sensible investing, saying it's gone down a load, so it must go back up. You need to look at what it's actually investing in, what the prospects are. Now, arguably, for Fundsmith, for example, it's got a very good track record. Terry Smith's got a very good track record. It holds a number of very well-established, profitable businesses with really good return on capital. Those are a lot more, they've got a lot better kind of prospects that you can evaluate. And you could go, right, okay, stock market's beaten down. The value of these companies has been beaten up. They're probably going to keep doing well in the future because that's the Terry Smith way of buying. It's a sort of Warren Buffett type way of buying. You buy stuff that's just going to deliver year after year after year after year. And it's a portfolio of companies, and those companies are probably going to keep delivering for years to come. So you might go, okay, well, yeah, I think I'm going to buy in. But that's not fallen by that much. That's down 15% year to date. Scottish Mortgage, on the other hand, is down 38.4% year to date. Well, when this article was written, that it involves much more speculative companies, much more disruptive growth style companies. Now, it might be that even though that's fallen by 38.4%, those companies were so highly valued that in this bubble that was potentially triggered by all of the cheap money sloshing around the world, and stuff has now changed. the era of all that cheap money and just more and more cheap money, and the Fed's always got your back, don't worry, stock market's full, the Fed's going to step in, is not here anymore. It's clearly far more worried about inflation than it is about bailing investors out. So it might be that they were, those stocks that it holds were so highly valued that even after a 38% fall, they're still quite expensive. And that's the decision that you have to make, rather than just going, it's down 38%, so it must go back up. Mm. And I say this as somebody who said in the past that if the stock market fell 30% again, I was buying, you know, dive in and buy. But that takes a certain amount of bravery. The stock market did fall 30-odd% in the COVID crash, and I didn't do what I said I was going to do. I wish I had, because I would have made lots of money. But then a lot of investors who did make lots of money in the COVID recovery bounce have now seen themselves fall back towards the level that they were previously at, because a lot of that stuff that's done really well since has now really, really, really suffered over recent months.
Mm. So the thing is, do your homework and know thyself.
Yeah, don't just buy stuff because it's gone up or down. Mm. That's not really a great way of investing. That's why people tell you not to do that all the time. So yeah, do your homework, look at it. Is this investment right for you? Do you agree with the things that it's investing in and its investment philosophy? And that's how you make the decision, not just it's gone down, so it'll go back up. And also, you know, consider the fact that maybe you don't want to be holding an actively managed fund. Maybe actually fund managers cannot consistently beat the market. Maybe you're just better off investing in the market and the power of companies to put money to profitable use, and you'd be better off with a global tracker fund.
Meanwhile, Tanya, though, you have been looking at the big picture trends that could make you a fortune, not just you, Tanya, lots of people, over the next couple of decades. And you've also come up with 11 funds and trusts to help you cash in. We don't have to go through all of those, but yeah, let's talk about the big picture themes that are likely to do well over the next few decades. That seems a very long time.
Yes, this is an idea that really comes out of the uncertainty we're in. You've obviously just heard Simon talking about all the turmoil that the markets have been in lately, the new interest rate era that we're embarking on. In the midst of all that uncertainty, where do you invest for the long term? And one way that was suggested by someone was at a Schroders conference on investment ideas and trends and so on, was that if you want to think your way out of the kind of current situation we're in now, think 20 years ahead and think big picture trends. This is where thematic investing, as it's called, top-down thematic investing, can come into its own, because whatever is going on at the moment, which is obviously interesting us all greatly and worrying a lot of us as well, there are certain things that are probably going to happen over the next 20 or 30 years. The population of the world is almost certainly going to grow. There's going to be greater need for food and for healthcare. Also, businesses and governments are going to have to increasingly step up investment in fighting a climate catastrophe that is looming over us. And within that, there are an awful lot of big picture trends in those broad three themes. There are others, obviously, but within that, there's an awful lot of scope to invest. I have to stress, though, that the key term here is long term. Big picture investing is quite exciting because you can take an idea of your own, your theory of the world or whatever, and really run with it. But you have to, I think, really stress test it in your own mind, and also you know, make sure that it's really going to last for the long haul.
What should you research before putting your money in thematic funds then?
We asked a number of experts about thematic big picture investing. The list that I'll run down is research the manager's philosophy. Well, Simon's already just pointed that out. That's obviously always very important. The power and durability of the theme, whatever it is. I would think that climate change is probably going to be a theme that's with us for a really long time, and people are going to be doing a lot about it for a long time, for example. And also, interestingly, you've got to work out if the universe of investments is big enough to fit what you're trying to do. There's no point in latching onto a quite a niche esoteric theme that you're really caught up in if there's not enough investments, a big enough spread of investments out there to meet your ambition, really. So those are the kind of things that you need to look at. when you're considering this kind of area.
Simon, your thoughts on this area?
I think it's very interesting. And I think that it's one of those ways that you can think of investing as a sort of core and satellite approach, that you have the core of your investments in broad-based funds, trusts, whatever. And then you have a smaller satellite of investments where you put your money into stuff that you're interested in or you think might do particularly well in the future. And you might think, oh, well, you know, the thing is, if I've only got a relatively small amount, even if it goes up, it doesn't make that much of a profit for me. But you're managing your risk there, because if it doesn't go up, you're also not going to make so much of a dent in your portfolio when you make a loss. But secondly, with some of these things, if they do really well in the future, then they can make outsized gains. So if you look at stock market returns, a lot of stock market returns come from a very small number of companies. And a lot of investors' returns come from a very small number of the investments they hold. So, but what you want to do is not put all of your eggs in one basket. And that's why it's really important to make sure that you don't have too much of your funds, of your portfolio, etc., in this kind of thing. You only have a small amount.
Before I leave this, Tanya, I did say at the start that you've come up with 11 funds and trusts to help you cash in. You can go to the top of the investing page on This Is Money to find that particular article if you want to read all 11. But have you picked your top three?
Well, these were all suggested to us by investing experts who I will credit here. The first is Juliet Schooling-Latter from Chelsea Financial Services. She came up with some suggestions which she split between broad thematic investment funds where they invest in an awful lot of themes. The first one of these would be Midwind International Trust, which has got 9 different themes that they're pursuing. So if you're interested in thematic investing, but you want to spread your risk within that, then that is one way of going. That has a 0.6 ongoing charge. One that Juliet again suggested would have a narrower focus, but also sounds incredibly interesting, is Sanlam Artificial Intelligence, ongoing charge 0.52%. So this is just looking at AI, but it can invest in any company or part of the world, from what I gather, where the companies will stand to benefit from AI in the future. And interestingly, it uses AI itself to track down these opportunities, which is quite appropriate. Rob Bergerman from Bruin and Dolphin, he made some interesting suggestions as well. I picked out Impact's Environmental Markets, pretty well-known investment trust, ongoing charge 0.85%. Obviously, this is going to give you exposure to the kind of investments that might do well in the drive towards a sort of net zero future. And there's a lot of scope for that because so many businesses and governments are already or are going to be pivoting to investing in that. It's quite a long-standing fund. It was one of the first to get into this area. So if you want a manager who's going to assess the best players who might come up with the most promising returns in that kind of field, then that might be one to look at.
All right then. Finally, before we go, petrol prices, you might have noticed, jumped again to push the cost of filling up a family car to over £100. So, asked Simon Lambert, is it time for a VAT cut to help motorists? Simon, this is your thought piece of the week, I suppose. I don't know if you probably have more than one, but this is the one that caught our eye. So is it time? Will it help?
Well, let me just say that I put a poll in our story. Should VAT be temporarily cut on petrol and diesel to tackle rocketing prices? And the vote is currently riding at yes, 94%.
Oh, okay.
And no, 6%. So we'd probably be quite popular judging on that. And that's off the back of almost 500 votes. And I understand there's a man who's looking around for popular policies at the moment for some reason. He might get a few people on his side with this one. And look, I filled up my car on Monday and it was almost empty. And it cost me just over 95 quid. And I thought, ouch, 95 quid. I'm glad I did it on Monday, though, because if I'd have left it till, I haven't actually driven it since then, but if I'd have left it until today, it would have been quite a bit more expensive than 95 quid. Now, if you look at the cost of filling up, I guess depending on how much you drive. Okay, so if you're someone who's driving a lot, this is a big issue. But if you're someone who just drives a fairly average amount, it's probably you're paying, you know, £15 more to fill up than you were perhaps a year ago on that kind of level that I'm talking about. You multiply that by the amount of times you fill up every month. It might be, you know, two or three times. Maybe you're paying like, you know, an extra 30 or 45 quid a month to fill up. It's quite a lot of money for most people. It's not a break the bank amount of money for most people though. Okay. I'm just going on a very broad average here. Okay. But boy, do you notice it. It's one of those real pinch points, the cost of filling up your car. And there are a lot of people, if they don't live in London or a handful of other major cities, who do rely on their cars. They rely on their cars to get to work. They rely on their cars to ferry their children around. They rely on their cars to go shopping, to do lots of other things. If you live in London, then it's fine. You get away with not having a car. You don't need to rely on it. If you live in a few other major UK cities, you can probably do it as well. Although public transport is pretty woeful outside of London in many places. But people are really feeling this, and the cost of filling up the average car has now gone past the £100 mark. It happened this week. So is the government going to do something about it? Well, what could it do about it? Well, it cut 5p off fuel duty in the budget. That has long ago, the effect of that has long ago been swallowed up by rising prices. And there's two things going on here. The oil price is going up and the pound has been going down, which exacerbates the issue. But what plays a major factor in the cost of filling up is tax. So tax accounts for 46% of a litre of unleaded petrol. That's a lot, right? So you've got fuel duty, which comes in at 52.95p. But then you've got VAT, which comes in at 30p on top of that. And there's a double taxation system with petrol, where you pay VAT on the fuel duty. You're paying tax on a tax. This is a uniquely unpopular thing amongst people, tax on tax. They're not so fond of the tax, and they definitely don't like the tax on the tax. This is often criticism of inheritance tax, which, whether that's actually true or not, I don't know. But with petrol, it's definitely true. You are definitely paying tax on tax. So should we've done the fuel duty cut, but should we ignore fuel duty? Should we actually cut the VAT? Because the thing is, the government is raking in more money. You know, as the price of petrol goes up, the government gets more VAT in. There are two points in favour of a VAT cut. Firstly, as I said, VAT revenue on fuel climbs as petrol prices climb. Secondly, emergency VAT cuts have been a tried and tested tool in successive chancellors' arsenals. We most recently saw it for restaurants and the hospitality industry in the COVID crisis. We've seen a blanket VAT cut previously after the financial crisis. They're relatively easy to implement. They're also relatively easy to reverse, which is why they possibly appeal quite a lot to chancellors, and people get them. It's like, yeah, I know, well, you temporarily cut VAT and now you're going to put it back up. Okay, all right, fine. It's a much more palatable way of raising tax, of putting a tax back up or raising taxes, than, for example, other taxes where people are much less used to them coming down and they get much more grumpy about them going back up. The argument against it is an environmental one. The reason why we pay so much tax on petrol is seen as a bad thing. Driving is seen as a bad thing. We don't want people driving all the time because it's polluting, it's bad for the environment, and it's bad for the atmosphere and the air that we breathe. So we want to stop people, we want to limit people's driving. We don't want super cheap petrol and everyone just driving everywhere. And if you decrease the tax on petrol, people will be more likely to drive than use public transport or perhaps cycle or walk. I guess there's two things going on there. One, we're well beyond that argument at the moment. We've got the cost of living crisis going on. We've got petrol prices spiraling. And also the environmental balance point that we were operating at with tax on petrol is way lower than the price that people are paying at the moment. So we could actually afford to bring the price down substantially, and we still end up at that same balance that we think we're running at. Secondly, I think that people running public transport in this country might be doing a great job of stopping people using it regardless of what we do with petrol prices at the moment, okay? Tube strikes, train strikes, woeful bus services, etc. And then also there's the element where it's accused of being regressive, right? Because the poorer you are, the very poorest people in society are much less likely to own a car. They don't have cars and they don't drive. The richer you are, the more likely you are to drive. Okay. But that does ignore the fact that there is a whole chunk of people in the middle who are absolutely reliant on their car and it's costing a small fortune. Mm. Today, I was reading about nurses, for example, who get a certain mileage allowance up to a certain point, and then beyond that they get a lower one, and it's now actually costing more to drive per mile than they're getting in the allowance, for example. This is one thing that was flagged. And people like nurses are a classic example of people who you quite often have to drive to get to work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big chunk of people in the middle, and maybe, just maybe, it might be time to cut VAT on petrol temporarily. Fine, if the oil price falls and the price comes down, put it back up. But maybe we need to stop the tax on the tax as the cost of filling up goes up and up, and forecasts widely are that we're going to hit £2 a litre at some point over the summer.
And the likelihood of it happening is,
I don't know. I'm not convinced Rishi Sunak is a big fan of this. I'm not convinced that Rishi Sunak has a problem paying to fill up his car, actually, to be honest. He's quite rich.
Now, Simon.
And he also, I mean, he's so rich, he fills up other people's cars.
It's true. We've seen it.
We've seen him do it. It's true. He does it. I think it'd be quite a popular idea with the Prime Minister, though. I think it's exactly the kind of thing that the Prime Minister would like to announce. So who knows? I mean, I tell you what. £2 a litre. Well, if the average price hits £2 a litre, there's going to be a huge clamour for this. And we're already starting to see more noise being made about it this week, including people like me writing columns about it.
Indeed. All right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.